Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hi out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for episode 96. We're going to have Linda Hilkema on board. She's the editor of La Pintura for the American Rock Art Research Association. This is going to be an open architecture wild ride. Don't miss this one. Well, hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And we're blessed and honored to have Linda Hilkema, who is both the editor of La Pintura, which is the newsletter for the American Rock Art Research Association, and also a board member with the California Rock Art Foundation as well. Linda, are you with us?
I sure am, Alan. I'm here.
Great. Well, it's wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
I think you've been on just once before, very, very early in the show's evolution. And you talked a bit about some of your research. Am I
right,
correct?
I was on with Donna Gillette together.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Linda, let's open it up this way. I want to, have some reflections to start off in terms of what prompted you to get involved in the study of rock art research, anthropology, archaeology, and the study of Native Americans. What was the source and the inspiration of that interest?
Well, I think it depends on how far back you want me to go. It actually started with my parents, who were avid history buffs. So my brother and I, growing up, my parents did a lot of camping, really remote camping, like the kind of camping out in the middle of nowhere that you need a four-wheel drive pickup to get to, very remote. And they were also avid history buffs. And we visited a lot of historical sites, a lot of archaeological sites, a lot of museums. So I had sort of this immersion very early.
And what area of the country was this in? Was it in California or somewhere else?
California, Nevada, Idaho, Washington, pretty much all the western United States, Arizona, New Mexico, predominantly in Nevada. My mother loved Nevada, especially northern Nevada. And we went to just about every ghost town you can think of in Nevada. And we looked at petroglyph sites as well and prehistoric sites. They just really loved history and archaeology. They were avocationalists.
Isn't that rare for a woman to have such a passion for an area that is so desolate, such as Nevada?
I don't know. I grew up with it, so it didn't seem odd to me. But my mother was very... She was very independent from a very young age. I mean, when she was a teenager, she took her Model A, in the 40s.
Really?
crossed Yosemite before the roads were paved. She went with a couple of girlfriends and she tooled around all over the place. So, and then my parents took their honeymoon. They drove up the Alcan Highway, went up into Alaska and went salmon fishing. And so they really loved that kind of stuff.
Sounds like they were very outdoorsy and loved adventure and loved history. What did they do for a living? Were they academics or were they just interested in history as an avocation?
So my father was an aerospace engineer. He worked for a number of engineering firms over the decades. Also, he and one of his college buddies started a military vehicle testing company in Northern Nevada. That company is still in business today.
Wow.
And my mom actually was an antique dealer up until her 80s. She was always self-employed. She was very independent. So they were very independent in their own different ways.
Sounds like it. When did you see your first rock art site? Do you remember? And what impressed you about them? And what caused you to care about these particular interesting and esoteric features on the landscape?
You know, I couldn't tell you how old I was when I saw my first rock art site. I just remember being just very young and hiking. You know, we would camp out in, you know, like the Black Rock Desert or wherever we were. And, you know, we would just go on these day-long hikes and we would just look at whatever was out there, whether it was the burrows or the ghost towns or, you know, the rock art. And it just was always very, you know, interesting to me. And so when I got into college, I started out as a psychology major and then added anthropology as a second major. So I actually double majored as an undergraduate. Did my first field school, I think in 1986. It was in Santa Cruz. I did my undergrad at San Jose State and got both my bachelor's degrees there.
And so you had two degrees, huh?
Two bachelor's degrees, psychology and anthropology. When I was deciding to go to grad school, I went to Cal State Hayward for my, I think they call it East Bay now, but Cal State Hayward for my master's degree. I was looking for a job in the college want ads, and I thought, oh, there's not going to be any archaeology positions. And lo and behold, there was one. There was a seasonal position with the Forest Service down in Sierra National Forest. And so I applied for it and got it. And so I worked for the summer, I think it was 1988, in Sierra National Forest, the North Fork District. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really any rock art up there per se, but we did record one very, very large ethnographic site that was several acres in size. And it was an ethnographic trading village for the Mono and the Yokuts. It was a summer gathering site. And it took us a long time to document the site because there were all of these different areas where the families were camping.
Huh. Where, was it an historic village site or was it?
It did have an historic component, and it was known to some of the local elders as a site that their ancestors would go to. So I think the site had some antiquity, but it also was recent. Yeah.
Did you connect with any of the elders while you were doing your research there?
We did. We had several Native peoples that we worked with.
Sure, but that was early. Yeah.
That was early. And after that, I did a number of jobs with CRM firms, but then I got hired as the district archaeologist for the Bureau of Land Management down in Hollister. And we also had a number of Native American people that we worked with down there. And that was where I kind of more really got into the rock art, was during that period of time.
Now, Hollister, is that in the Central Valley or is that in the Bay Area?
So Hollister is very, very, very southern Bay Area. It's in San Benito County.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of rock art was in the Hollister area?
Mostly cupules and bedrock mortars. They were almost always in association, but there were a few other sites that had PCNs or the PECT curvilinear nucleated rock art types that Donna Gillette did for her thesis and dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of pictograph rock art, not very much.
Uh-huh.
And it was in very poor, what little there was in very poor condition from weathering, et cetera. But when I was with the BLM, it was kind of difficult for me to do assessments because we didn't really have a good management plan for the district. And so I had just started grad school at that time, and I proposed doing a site settlement study for my master's thesis, but also would be used as a basis for the cultural resources management plan for the BLM.
Yeah.
And so I was able to kind of marry the two.
Yeah. So it sounds like from the get-go, you had a good position with a management agency, and you were connecting with some of that rather unusual and distinctive, yet enigmatic and mysterious rock art, correct?
Correct. Right, right. I did a settlement study. I basically just took all of the sites that were recorded and noted their geographic position, whether they were on a canyon mouth or on a ridgetop or whatever, and what kind of sites they were, and just did this big matrix. And I happened to include, I don't remember offhand how many sites had rock art, but maybe a quarter of the sites had some component of rock art, even if it was just cupules.
Sure. So I guess fast forward to your recent association with the California Rock Art Foundation, but also with the American Rock Art Research Association. Tell me how you got connected with ARERA and what ARERA is and what your role with them has been.
ARERA is the American Rock Art Research Association, and I believe we have members from countries around the world. I don't know how many, but I would say maybe 40 countries around the world. I could be wrong.
Wow.
I'm good friends with Donna Gillette, and she, of course, is on the CRAF board, but I've known Donna for probably 30 plus years, and she kind of encouraged me to go to ARERA, and so I went to some ARERA conferences and liked it. I don't describe myself as a rock art researcher, but I like it and I advocate for its protection and I enjoy it. And I was at an ARERA conference, I think in 2018, and the current editor at the time was mentioning that she really needed to step down as editor. And I sort of foolishly said, "Oh, that sounds like fun." And she said, "Good, you're it." And so,
oh my word.
So I've been the editor now for about 3 years, and we put out 4 newsletters a year on various.
So how long has ARERA been around, and what do they do? And what is the newsletter like? How long has the newsletter been around, and how many issues? It's, a million questions, please.
Oh boy. So I'll have to get back to you on how long ARERA has been around. I could cheat and go to their website right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
The newsletter has been around for many, many years. It used to be a printed publication, a black and white printed publication. And right after I came on board, we switched over to a digital format.
Okay.
It's still 4 times a year, but it's a digital format. And we accept articles on basically wherever people are doing rock art research. It doesn't just have to be the Americas. It can be Australia or, Africa or wherever.
So anywhere in the world.
It's predominantly American, but not exclusively.
Okay. And do they have conferences meetings outside of America or no?
I don't know if they have conferences outside of America. I've maybe been to 5 or 6 of them, and they're in various, locations, around the country.
Yeah.
The ones I've been to have always been on the sort of the western side of the United States, I'm presuming, because they have more rock art. The upcoming one is going to be in Tucson.
Okay.
And they always have great field trips.
Yes, that's what people go for, is, of course, the field trips as well. So you've been an editor for the ARERA newsletter. What's that like? And how many members are there in ARERA?
I think we have about 500 members.
Oh my word, I had no idea. Wow.
The ARERA newsletter is really fun to do. It's always challenging to get content. So
sure,
I end up begging a lot for content.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I find that if I throw out a topic to people and I usually get more responses that way, like women in archaeology or something. People will can relate to a theme.
Sure.
And so I get articles that way. We have Native Americans, of course, on our in our group, and they submit articles as well as, you know, non-Native scholars.
Uh-huh. And what's been some of the more interesting articles or contributions or research?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot for that.
Yeah, no, just what do you feature? Yeah.
Well, this last edition focused mainly on describing various rock art places in the southern Arizona region, because that's where our upcoming conference is going to be. And so we just have a number of fabulous sites that are around. We have I'm probably saying it wrong, Kokoraki Ranch.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, let's hold that idea for the next segment. And I want to hear all about the rock art in Arizona and what you featured in the newsletter. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. We're here at the Rock Art Podcast, episode 96. We're pressing towards the millennial, the centennial mark. We have Linda Hilkema as our guest scholar this episode. This is segment two. And I think we're going to start talking about some of the things that were featured in the American Rock Art Research Association, La Pintura newsletter. Linda, you were just about to tell us about some of the extraordinary sites that exist, I think, in Arizona, correct?
Mm-hmm. Southern Arizona.
Yeah.
One of our trips is going to be to Kokoraki Butte in the Ironwood Forest National Monument. And this particular site has one of the largest known selections of bell rocks in southern Arizona. And I believe those are rocks that have certain acoustic properties.
You know what they're called, Linda? They're called lithophones. And lithophones are archaeology. Yeah, acoustic archaeology. They're rock gongs. They had them in Yokuts country in the southern San Joaquin Valley as well. I don't know if they're common or uncommon, but I guess when you hit a lithophone, a gong rock, with another rock, it produces a ringing sound. And so that's your archaeoacoustic lecture for right now. And I believe that they were ritually or ceremonially important to certain cultures, or they were perhaps used in certain ceremonies or other ritually significant events.
I would imagine this will be my first time seeing those. And the area where these rocks are, there's apparently in the immediate area, like over 2,000 petroglyph elements on boulders around them. So it was a very important, you know, area at one time.
Well, one of the things that, of course, indigenous people believed, and this is sort of the Native American perspective on this, is that all things, both things that we would consider inanimate as well as animate, have what we call agency. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by agency is they believe they're alive and they have a force and they have a sentience and a knowledge and they can make choices and they can act as humankind. So when a lithophone was found, a rock gong, obviously it was speaking as though it was emanating from the rock. And so, you know, when they talk about the rocks begin to speak or talking mm-hmm. stones, etc., that's what this is. It has a force, it has a knowledge, it has a sound. And I think some of the things I was taught, I did only one article on archaeoacoustics, and it was with one of the originators of that whole discipline of archaeoacoustics.
It's very fascinating to me, and I've never really experienced them before, so I'm looking really forward to not only just seeing them and hearing them, but, you know, looking at how they're perched on the landscape and how they relate to everything else that's going on around them.
One of the hypotheses that those that are involved with archaeoacoustics believe is that certain rocks or certain landforms were selected because they had acoustic properties. So in other words, if there was an area that was echophonic or was a natural amphitheater that would echo one's voice, that the rock art would be emblazoned or would be situated such to take advantage of that phenomenon.
Do you think they were first signaling, or do you think
no,
they were?
No, I don't think they were used in any sort of conventional way or for communication. I think it was perceived that there was life in the rocks, and as they were ringing, that they were communicating something, some nature, some sort of message from them. And I'm not sure what that message was, but I would say that it involved something that was powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the native people tended, and tell me if you think this is intuitively correct, when I've known native people and spoken to them, it appears to me that speaking is less important than listening. Mm-hmm. So sound becomes critically important. Listening to the sounds of the world, nature, what someone else perhaps is saying is far more important than what you're going to say or how you're going to communicate. And they tend to relate best to those people who in turn are listening to sounds rather than wanting to speak or communicate at great length. So in other words, I wouldn't be someone who perhaps would find many kindred spirits in Native Americans because I love to talk so much. but if I listen, and if I listen to them or listen to the sounds of an environment or what the environment is telling me, then that is much more akin to the way in which Native people grok the universe. They tend to be much more ethereal and much more associated with the land, the landscape, the natural world, whatever is around them. Do you agree or no?
Oh, I totally agree. And I can relate to that because when I go hiking or when I'm camping, I never wear headphones. I always want to hear, and I sometimes really just enjoy sitting and listening to, you know, whatever the birds are doing or whatever the wind is doing. And it drives me crazy when I see people hiking, you know, in the foothills up here, and they're either blabbing away really loud or they've got headphones on and they're not listening. And one of my favorite things to do is when I'm, you know, out somewhere is to just sit and listen. So the world will really speak to you if you listen. And
I took two Native Americans into Little Petroglyph Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And they began, walking the canyon with everyone. And then all of a sudden they both sat down. Mm-hmm. And I go, what's going on? He said, we want to sit here. We don't want to walk any further. And I go, why is that? He says, because we want to listen. We want to hear the images and hear what they have to say and process this place. And we can't process the place if we're constantly walking and talking. And so I said, okay, well.
I can relate to that. I can understand that. And to sit and also absorb the scents or the smells of a place as well. Like if you're somewhere out after a rain and you have the smell of the earth and the sage, and if you just sit there and listen and smell, you have all these different sensory experiences. And it's very illuminating.
I think for the most part, when I've connected with Native people, they're far more kinesthetic than many of us are. I'm very visual, I don't think it, maybe sometimes even auditory, but visual is the main element that I connect with. But I believe that Native people and those that relate to Native people most effectively are heavily kinesthetic. Do you agree?
I think so. I know.
They feel the world. They want to sense. They want to move slower. They want to touch and sense and feel and connect and listen.
Exactly. No, I understand that. I agree with that completely, because sometimes it is just best to just sit and listen. And it's amazing how much you see and hear and can learn when you're just sitting and watching over a landscape for a
and listening.
Period of time.
I went with e-viewing. I was out in Utah. She and I are both avid rock art, passionate researchers. She has published a bit and taken 100 trips into the Great Mural Rock Art in Baja on top of a mule. And she and I both went to this petroglyph site. And she always sits down and begins to look at it. And me, I'm all over it, you know, wondering here and there and anywhere.
Well, when I was in Sago Canyon, just looking at those incredible figures, I actually sat down too. And I was just looking at them. But you can't take your eyes off of them. But at the same time, you start to hear the birds and you just, it's just amazing. There's a presence. They have a presence and you can feel it.
Yeah. So the first sort of anecdotal story is when I sat down and waited and sat with her and began to look, I began to process the images in a way I hadn't processed them before. And I began to see things that I hadn't seen before and began to see the connections and began noting things that I hadn't noted before. Mm-hmm. And I know that Eleni Moore, who's a rather famous rock art artist who replicates rock art sites, is exactly the same way. She sat down and viewed the panels and paintings in that enormous cave, the largest cave of rock art in the Great Mural area, and spent weeks, months, years just going over and over and over, looking at the same images again and noticing every jot and tittle regarding the things that she gets to see. And I know that I've done the same thing with the photographs that I have of Koso rock art. Every time I've gone back and viewed them again and looked at them closer, don't you know, I see new things. I see with new eyes. I begin to see other relationships and things that I hadn't seen before.
And it's different every time. And you're always seeing something new, which is why, you know, a place like Little Pet Canyon or the Great Mural, it's always fascinating to go back there because you see something different every time, or you process it differently. That's a, could be another thing is maybe you process it differently than the last time you were there.
Right.
Thinking of pictographs, a great mural, I was listened to a lunchtime lecture from Shumla, and forgive me, I don't know the acronym off the top of my head, but I can get it for you. But it was on preparing the pigments for the pictographs. Mm-hmm. And it's an extremely involved and lengthy process to gather the pigments themselves and to process the binder, whether it's cactus juice or whether it's whatever it is they're using for a binder, but just the whole process of making enough pigment, you know, going to get it, processing it, making it, storing it, that process alone. And then you look at some of the large figures. And if you've ever painted a picture, you know how much paint it takes to paint something. So it's not just a matter of, you know, going out and painting something. There's a tremendous amount of work that has to be done, much like making a basket. You don't just pick up plants and start making the basket. You have to collect them at the right time and you have to, you know, process them and dry them. And, you know, it's a whole very involved process. And I had never thought of pictographs in that way before, that it may take a year or more to, you know, process enough pigments to do an image that you are going to do.
So the preparation is an element that one should consider when one sees one of these elaborate, multicolored, just jaw-dropping paintings.
I would imagine that the ritual of preparing the pigment is every bit as important. Well, I'm projecting.
I would guess so.
I would imagine that it's just as important as the image itself.
Well, when we think of pigment, I do know from ethnographic information and the reading that I've done, when they talked to Wovoka, who was the range shaman who was responsible for the ghost dance in 1890, pigment, red pigment, was what he would send to people and ask them for donations. And he would get donations from Indian tribes all over the country and around the world because they felt that that pigment, that red pigment that he would send them was alive and so powerful and so important to the nature of who they were and what they were doing to have life. It was alive, and it was a critical element to the nature of the trade and the nature of sort of gathering something that really was a piece of land.
And I wonder if it had to do with the fact that it's the same color as blood.
Yes. Yeah, because it means blood.
Oh, sorry.
It means blood. It means yes. Earth. It means life. Mm-hmm. So the color red to the Nummik, to the Great Basin Paiute Shoshone, meant the land. Red was the land. Red mm-hmm. was life. Red was blood. Red was this particular most powerful color, and it also meant joy and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that sort of colorful language and associated symbolism was all wrapped up in that particular element. Well, we're out of time on the second segment. See y'all in the flip-flop, gang. All right, gang, here we are on segment 3 on episode 96. Your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're going to put the icing on the cake and the candles in it and then roll it away. Here we go. Linda, you're here?
I am here.
Well, let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about some of the more ethereal and interesting sort of riffs that we can have with rock art.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories that I have, it's an anecdotal story again, is I went to Utah. I was the keynote speaker at the Utah Rock Art Research Association,
mm-hmm.
and they had a field trip. So I went out to one of those enormous canyons. I don't know if it was Seago Canyon or not. It's the one with the with that praying animal human figure, and then the sort of the kingly people that were up on the wall.
Oh yes, yes.
And so we drove in there. I wasn't driving, and then we parked the vehicle, and I got out of the vehicle. And I immediately had vertigo. I could not even stand up.
Mm.
I was like blown away by the landscape. It was so overpowering and so disconcerting to me to be standing there with this rock shelf that's sort of leaning over me, towering above me, and this other thing kind of coming at me. It just confused the hell out of me in terms of where I was and how to stand properly. And I almost fell down. I'm absolutely serious. I'm not exaggerating.
No, I believe that. You know, it's interesting. You go, I believe it's Seago Canyon, but I might be wrong. I might have to correct myself later. You go into this canyon, and like you said, there's this huge vertical wall and these huge figures, and they're stunning, but you also look at how they're placed on the landscape. You know, they are meant to be seen. I mean, they are just right at the head of this canyon, and you can't miss them. Whereas, you know, there's other rock art that is probably not meant to be seen. I've seen rock art that's underneath, that's like there are slabs and there's rock art like underneath, or they're in hidden, you know, hard to get to places. And so just the fact that
yes.
these figures were like guarding the canyon was astonishing.
I agree. Yeah. And I think when I've looked at the Koso rock art that I've looked at for 50 years, I think that's a similar phenomenon. What I see in this canyon that gave me vertigo, and I've seen it also in Little Petroglyph Canyon, is there's sometimes a relationship between the images that appear that are these
mm-hmm.
decorated animal human guardian like prophetic ancestor shamanistic ancestor deity like figures that are usually very large and very impressive. And then if you look over and under at a lower elevation, there's usually sometimes a smaller figure and it is adoring or paying homage or supplicating itself to those figures. And they will be having their hands open, and those hands are directed in an elevated fashion out in front of themselves, out there, you know, in that supplication mode. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. It's so fascinating. It's so fascinating.
But I mean, that sort of, again, shows the gestural nature sometimes of rock art imagery, mm-hmm, that can communicate to viewers across hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Isn't that wild?
Right. There are some images that are just sort of, that you find cross culture, you know, the sun or hands or whatever. There's just certain images that you can relate to, and it doesn't matter if they're 500 or 5,000 years old.
Our friend, who's a board member, Aaron Barnia, has taken cinematography photographs all over the world of one kind of image, and that's the long-horned these enormous beings, animals that have these enormous horns or antlers, right?
Yeah,
and they're normally centrally placed in certain cultures. So he studied the comparisons of what those horned figures are doing and how they relate cosmologically, religiously, to the cultures that are depicting them.
Does that have anything maybe to do with the fact that a lot of the large horned creatures in real life are maybe primary food sources, and so they're very important to the people that are depicting them? And that's
certainly part of it, yes. That's part of the story. But what they found is when they study the animal remains of these people, you know, the actual economic animal bones, they're not usually the principal animals that they're eating. They're good to eat, but they're more good to think, because you can't get many of them. They're normally fairly hard to hunt. And if you can get a couple of them, it's sort of a feast, right?
Right.
Because they're big animals. Yeah. But one of the most amazing things that he told me, and I was somewhat shocked when he told me this, because I wasn't sure about my assessment. I said, you know, I've looked at these animals. They're on the rocks here. They're figures. They're artiodactyls. They're, you know, large game animals.
Mm-hmm.
And they represent them on the rocks. And they like to show their big horns, right? Because they're called big horns.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sheep. So, and they show the bodies. They're big. And the legs are, you know, rather small or dainty or thin. But one anatomical detail that they almost always have that you never see on a real life animal is what?
Their tail.
They're always showing tails, and you never see tails on bighorn sheep. They tuck them neatly within their backside, and they're relatively tiny. Why do they show these tails all the time, right? And so they also show the tails not tucked neatly, but they're parallel to the ground, or they're sometimes upturned towards the sky. And so a lot of people have written about this, and I was always curious to know why the heck they would do that. Well, when I talked to Aaron Barnia, he says, oh yeah, all over the world, wherever I go and look at them, they have the same thing going on. They always show their tails. Their tails are up or parallel to the ground, toward the sky.
I wonder if some of these large animals, I think they flick their tails when they're trying to communicate either danger, or they're trying to communicate to other members of their group. And I wonder if there's some sort of parallel there, possibly.
So what I found was, when I began to ask the wildlife biologist, right, is they said the only time that their tails are up or moving is in estrus. And they do a thing called flagging. So the females wag their tails to tell the males that they're open for reproduction.
I was going to say it probably has something to do with reproduction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a sign of of vitality, of increase, of sort of that that element of reproductive fertility. And when he's asked other archaeologists about that same question in other parts of the world, they all explain it exactly the same way I just did, which I was shocked. I had no idea.
There's got to be some truth to it if it's...
Yes, yes, yeah. So
it's one of those universal symbols.
Yeah, it's a universal symbol, and it's something that's being rendered on the rocks in a way that only someone who has listened and seen and sensed the world and got a real intimate connection with animal habits and habitat to know.
And behavior.
That behavior. Yeah. Yeah. So this comes back again full circle to really understanding the world, the natural world, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, it and would it have to do with seasonality or, you know, is it, I don't know when the animals.
It is a seasonal
calving
thing.
Season, because but, they, you know, if it has to do with animal reproduction and the health of the ecosystem or whether it.
They've studied the same same phenomenon on those big game animals that are depicted at, you know, Lascaux and the other places, you know, the 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. They have found that their seasonality indicators based on how they're depicted, when they're depicted, and the actual frequencies of those little dots that appear on the walls. They're almost like a counting or numerical system that relates back to the months or the frequency of when those animals reproduce and when they're available for hunting.
Well, you could almost think of it as maybe even a language. I mean, we always think of our language as symbols, but maybe these rock art elements, by the way they're depicted, they're, you know, they have specific, you know, like we just said, seasonality or other elements that they're depicting. It's almost like they're telling you, or that
it's almost a proto language, correct?
Think of it as maybe a language.
Yeah, I think it's a proto language. Sandy Rogers and I think Robert Yowie interviewed an Owens Valley Paiute about rock art in the Owens Valley in Eastern California. And what he said was that these are storyboards, that we write our stories on the rocks. And I haven't talked that much about it, but there's a panel in Little Petroglyph Canyon that I discovered that is a creation narrative. It's a creation story, and it's one that's a archaic Uto-Aztecan creation story. And it's as plain as day. I mean, it's not superimposed. It's a very clear and precise description of this creation story, and it's there on the rocks. Only if one was schooled in that particular arena would one understand that. And fortunately, it was something that I had run across, you know, from Shumla, actually. And Carolyn Boyd talks about the image has to do with the fiveness or the archaic Uto-Aztecans and how they examined the world early on when there was no life in the world and following in the darkness the lunar goddess and then creating the sun, then lifting up the heavens so that the sun would have enough of a sort of a landscape to move about the sphere and not burn up the place or freeze it.
And it's interesting that that panel, you said, that didn't have any superposition on it, or
nothing. It's so clear. Yeah, yeah. It's like it was impressive and just telling a story in such a way that the native people could share that with others.
And it was important enough or unique enough or for whatever reason that it didn't get superimposed on, you know, so many panels have two, three, or, you know, different layers of images on top of images.
Well, we're closing in on the third segment. Would you like to give any messages out to our listeners?
If you have the opportunity to go visit any rock art sites anywhere, do so. And it doesn't really matter if you want to study or make it you know, focus of your study, just know that they're there and that they're sacred spaces and they're important and they need to be preserved and protected. And they're just iconic pieces of the landscape that are very enduring, and they're special and they need to be preserved and protected.
They're treasures, as I call them. They're immortals on the rocks. Thank you, Linda. See you on the next one. Catch you on the flip-flop.
Thank you, Alan.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.